Hi, everyone. It's Hillary here with a quick reminder for you. This week, we're going to be rebroadcasting one of our absolute favorite episodes while we're working on our next round of truly inspiring interviews. It's definitely worth a second listen or a first if you missed it the first time around. And we'll be back with new episodes soon. Now, on to the show. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am delighted to welcome a woman who I personally have followed for years, home style expert and design guru, Emily Henderson. She has been a part of my life from afar for a very long time. I watched her when she won HGTV's Design Star, and then she had a couple of seasons of an amazing show called Secrets from a Stylist. I also love her blog, Style by Emily Henderson. She's also Target's home expert and has a New York Times bestselling book, Styled Secrets for Arranging Rooms from Tabletops to Bookshelves. But before she was running a super successful website, working as an interior designer and renovating homes, she actually worked as a prop stylist and was just trying to figure out her path forward. I'm so excited to have her on the pod today. So now, with no further ado, it's Emily Henderson on Second Life. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Talk to me about what you studied in school and what you thought you were going to be when you grew up.
Okay. I studied comparative literature and history. I grew up in a very small town. Before the internet, it was literally like teacher, doctor, lawyer, you know, that kind of situation.
Yes.
So both my parents are teachers, and I guess I assumed that that would be what I would do. But it was the 90s where you studied whatever interests you. You didn't study what you thought you were going to be. You know what I mean? Maybe
yes.
People do that still, but like everybody that works for me that is in their 20s, they studied what career they wanted, which I think is a lot smarter of an approach than just like, oh, I like to read. I'm going to just study English. But anyway, so that's what I studied, which I guess at the time I wanted to be a teacher. But then as soon as I graduated, I realized that I wanted to be around pretty things. And I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that I liked pretty things.
That's interesting that you say that, though, because I, too, studied literature because I thought if I'm going to study something for 4 years, it might mm-hmm. as well just – why can't I just read books for 4 years? That sounds like a great idea. And I had a – journalism was my minor. So I picked that up towards the end where I thought, okay, like it was going to be difficult to say – you know, I'm going to be a novelist when I graduate.
Right.
I thought it was really nice to learn for the sake of learning. And now everything is like learning for a purpose. And I don't think one is necessarily better than the other, but there was something very luxurious about learning just because you were interested.
I think you're right. I think I'm being a little bit narrow-minded with my – I think I like to punish myself for not having skills, and that is how I do it. And I tell everybody this in college to at least have a minor in something that requires a skill. So you had journalism. That was smart of you. I had history was my minor. It's like that – again, like I love storytelling. It makes sense. You know, now that I'm older, I realize why I did study those two things. But generally, I give it the advice that you should try and learn at least one – applicable skill in college, and I didn't. However, it worked out.
Practical skills are good. I will give you that.
Yes.
So tell me about your first adult job.
I don't know what you mean by that. So here's what I can tell you. I graduated, moved to New York, was dog walking, bartending, teaching piano, just kind of doing anything that I could to give me enough time to figure out what I wanted to do.
Why New York?
My boyfriend at the time was an actor and was going to NYU grad school for acting. I just wanted to move there because I had been born and raised in Oregon and just, I mean, of course I wanted to move to New York City. So we landed, had nothing. I had no real goals. I started taking design classes. And I guess my first grown-up job, but you can tell me if you think this is a grown-up job. I really don't think I had a grown-up job until like 4 years ago. But I started working at Jonathan Adler because I wanted to be around pretty things, and I felt that he had, you know, really fun sense of humor. He didn't take design seriously. I had no background in design, so I just I responded to the whimsy. It was very loud, and it was very like I am design. Come and look at me. And I think that like that was perfect for where I was in my kind of design upbringing. Like, I loved it. So started working for him mostly as a shop girl, but when he was like tiny, you know, just like a little shop on Green Street. And through that, I was introduced to this world of prop styling.
Okay, so how did you get that introduction, and what was that like?
So I was in Jonathan Adler, and mm-hmm. all of these people would come through and rent things and shop and essentially, you know, they're doing it for editorial, for magazines, catalogs, advertising, for photography.
Editors.
No, freelance stylists.
Got it. Okay.
So these freelance stylists would come through, and it just seemed like a way more fun job than what I was doing at the time. So I chatted with a couple of them, and they just said, yeah, we shop and make things all the time. And that sounded like a lot of fun.
That does sound very attractive. Mm-hmm.
So I think I was 24. I just started writing letters to all of them. Maybe there was email then. I don't know. Like, I think email existed, but it wasn't something that, especially for New Yorkers that were freelance, they weren't on their computers all the time. So I actually wrote letters to all of them that I had met. And just tried to make it as compelling as possible. Like, you can't not hire this person. She has no experience. She has no practical skills. But I really tried to convince them that I was the hardest worker and had the best attitude. So I got hired by a few. And one of them, she booked me consistently enough that I was full-time for the stylist named Cindy DePrima for years. And it was wonderful.
So what kind of stuff were you doing? Was it mostly editorial shoots or advertising shoots? And what were your sort of responsibilities?
She was an editor at Martha Stewart that had just previously left. And so it was mostly freelancing back at Martha Stewart, which is amazing because Martha Stewart is like the magazine is pretty much like the grad school for stylists. So you can be a stylist and get work. But once you've worked for Martha Stewart, then your skills and your style, it's that much better. You know, she trains you how to be a good stylist. Martha Stewart, Anthropology, Target, a lot of editorial beyond that. And most of my job was just assisting shopping, sourcing, schlepping. I mean, I'm sure you've all heard how much prop stylists have to just carry stuff around. But it was so much fun. Every day is different. Every shoot is different. The amount that you learn about resourcing, but also like just visuals is huge. I learned on the job. I think it's a very good way to start and build your career.
So I think one of the things about whether it's the fashion world or it's the design world is that people see it from the outside and it looks so glamorous. They see, you know, a stylist walk into a room and there are these racks of clothes that are and shoes or someone walks on set and there are 47 beautiful vases in all of these different colors. But they don't think about the fact that someone had to actually like procure all of those things and set all of those things up and then has to go through and wrap everything up and make sure everything is returned correctly and all of that stuff. That requires like a very organized, analytical, responsible, methodical part of the brain. And then the other side of it, which is the creative part of like what goes with what and how are we going to make the shot perfect and mm-hmm. how are we going to execute the vision is a very different part of the brain. Did you feel like you had both sides developed pretty early on or was one side harder for you?
I'm a good helper. I'm one of six kids as number four. So I think that like just making sure that things ran properly and that things were organized, that I knew that was my job. And so I am not detail oriented. I am not particularly like type A, but I knew it was my job. So I did it. I knew that my boss should not be responsible for making sure that, you know, the returns were done in a timely manner. The visuals part of it, I did not it took me a while to be good at knowing what a good photo was. That's for sure. This is back in the day when it was film, and so you're staring at a Polaroid. You're not staring at a monitor where you're taking, 500 shots to get the one. You're taking maybe 10 shots to get the one because film is expensive. So I used to ask Cindy, I was like, wait, why isn't that composition good? And she would explain to me, staring at this Polaroid, why just having it be right in the center and having it be, something hitting something else just a little bit is why that's a bad thing. But if I hadn't been trained, I don't know how I would – I mean, I guess hopefully I would have just picked it up. But it was definitely – that part of the job was a visual training that I think a lot of people may have gotten in art school. But since I didn't go to art school, I did not get. So I don't know. I think that my – I'm definitely more of the creative brain than the other side that you talked about. But
the analytical piece of it.
Yeah. But I had to be – good at it in order to keep getting hired, because nobody's going to hire, someone that's just, a snow show that has, no – no organizational system at all.
I think that it's an interesting thing, too, thinking about, how much you actually learn on the job. And I think oftentimes people come to their career or to a job and they think they need to know everything. It's like, no, so much of the training happens when you're actually there. You just have to get your foot in the door and then say yes to things.
I agree. And this is a debate we have at the office all the time, that I do not like the fake it till you make it mentality. I want to know, okay, if I'm hiring somebody entry level, do not pretend that you know anything. Tell me what you don't know. You are here to learn from me and for me to tell you exactly how the best way in my experience that we have done something. Now, do I want their opinion? Of course, I want their input. But I've had people before that they're embarrassed to not know something, so it takes them hours to get something done when they could have just asked and been like, oh, no, here's how we've done it. The on-the-job training is so important, and being open to it and just being, yes, I am here to learn. I'm not here to pretend that I know everything, I think is extremely important if you are just starting out.
It's also interesting because I'm assuming you had to be resourceful, too, in terms of sourcing. And maybe you didn't know every single place to – every showroom or every place to borrow something from in New York City at that point in your career. How did you figure that stuff out? Were you just asking questions? Were you the person who was, making all those connections on the side in your own time? How did you develop that sort of resourcefulness in – your early career?
I do think it was a lot about relationships, because it was before smartphones. So you did have to ask around. I was a girl from Oregon living in New York, and I was like a tourist attraction with how friendly I was. Everybody's like, God, you really can get stuff out of people because you're so nice. And I was like, yeah, just be nice to people. And then you ask them for a favor and they'll tell you where they got that or they'll end up lending it to you even if it's not typically for rent. I remember one time I had to get this tobacco leaf for I think it was a perfume shoot. And it was meant to just be a pretty looking leaf on a still set. And they're illegal to get, and we didn't have time to overnight them from Cuba or wherever we were supposed to get one. But I had heard about this liquor store on the Upper East Side that had them. It was kind of like an old boys club in the back. And so I went up there and I bought a really expensive piece or bottle of, I think it was of whiskey or something. And I had talked to him on the phone and I was being friendly. And I showed up and I was like, listen, if I show up on set tomorrow with this and I'll bring it back, I will be the hero. Everybody will be so impressed. And it just means so much, so much to me. And I gave him the bottle of whiskey. And I mean, he couldn't say no. I was going to bring it back. I was obviously not going to turn him in. I was, I was a 25-year-old, little blonde girl. I wasn't, this wasn't a sting. So he gave it to me. And anyway, I just remember after being if you try hard enough, you can lock anything down. But it was so fun, having those little missions of whether it was we need an accordion from the 1920s that's red. That's really fun to try and find.
Well, it's like a scavenger hunt every day. So you were a prop stylist. And how long did you do that?
I was a prop stylist for 5 years. Let's see. Actually, I can go back. I was a stylist assistant for 4 years and then a prop stylist for 2 or 3 before we moved to LA.
What made you decide to go out on your own? And were you scared? Did you have like a client list? Did you have a big plan?
No. I was forced to go out on my own. It was one of those things where Cindy was like, you are ready. Stop saying no to these jobs. You're ready. And I was like, no, I'm not. I haven't learned everything I need to learn. I was terrified, you know, as you can imagine. And she just kept saying, you'll never know everything you need to know. Every shoot will be different for the rest of your life. You just need to do it. So she was so busy that she would give me her clients that she doesn't have time to do. So it would be like my very first job was Parent Magazine, and it was styling out a toy trunk for like a one-page shoot. And I was nauseous. I was so nervous. The responsibility and the fact that I didn't have anybody that was in charge of how it looked was just terrifying. And then when it went well, it was pretty terrifying for, I would say, the first year. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, people are still calling. Like, mm-hmm. I must not be a disaster at it. And, it ended up working out. But, I mean, I will say it really helped that assisting for somebody that was so entrenched in the industry, like, everybody knew me. The photographers knew me. The editors knew me. The photo directors knew me. So if, you know, I don't think I was their top choice when I was just starting out, but if they didn't have people that were available, they're like, oh, that Emily girl was, she worked really hard and was really nice. Let's give her a shot. So I think people want to go out on their own really early these days. And I think there's something to be said for assisting somebody really good and also getting established in the industry, even as an assistant, is still very valuable.
I agree wholeheartedly. And it's also nice that you had, it sounds like, Cindy's blessing.
Yeah.
So you'd been in New York for a while, mm-hmm. and then you decided to move to LA. Mm-hmm. What was the impetus for that? And were you worried about what that would do to your career? Because there's obviously a lot of, there are still a ton of shoots and clients and all that stuff in Los Angeles, but New York is, to a degree, the epicenter.
Yeah, it was, let's see. My husband and I had gotten married the year before, and he is a theater actor, and he was doing really well, doing some Broadway, off-Broadway, had gotten his master's in it. So he was ready to move to L.A. to, you know, try the Hollywood thing. And I was not ready to move. But after a certain point of somebody, you know, your partner wanting to, you sacrifice. And so we did it. To be fair, he wasn't ready to leave New York either, but it was going to be good for his career. So we moved to LA. We moved to LA a week before the writer's strike in 2008.
No.
Yeah. And Hollywood was shut down. So there's no work for Brian. I kept booking shoots from New York. So I would, you know, if Domino Magazine came out to LA, if they didn't want to have to fly somebody out, they would book me. So I was staying kind of busy, but it was definitely not like I was by any means. And so,
were you worried about money?
We were living so we were so poor for all of our 20s. So I was just used to living paycheck by paycheck, you know. So it wasn't that big of a deal. But yeah, I mean, I knew that I had taken a step back in my career for sure by moving to LA.
So what happened next? So you're in LA.
So
you're still prop styling.
Mm-hmm. I was watching a lot of HGTV. I didn't know what to do. There was not going to be a full career as a prop stylist here, and I knew it. And so, as a joke, I went on Design Star, and I
love that there was a process, I am assuming, too. How did you apply? Like, what did you think it was going to be? Did you want to do interior design? Like, what was your thought process?
I guess while watching HGTV, I felt like there wasn't somebody that I could relate to, or there wasn't a show that I felt was really my show. So while auditioning was definitely like this hilarious story for me to tell people, you know, obviously there was part of me that did think that, like, well, what if I could have the show that related to me? So the audition process was weird, and, you know, it was like a group of hundreds of people. You're doing 5-minute, you know, one-on-ones with casting directors, and then they just follow up every week. They call you to ask you more questions. Like, so they're also, like, casting you as a character, too. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about, like, your skills and your style. It's very much like, who are you going to be in this group of 13 people? once I got on, it was crazy. I always say it was the best and worst 6 weeks of my life. You know, it was insane, and it was an adrenaline rush. And we were working from 5 or 6 a.m. until midnight, and it was terrifying. And I didn't thrive at first at all, but it was very exciting, obviously, and winning it was a wonderful thing. So,
did you think you were going to?
No.
When you're in the finals, you have to have some sense that it's a possibility.
In the finals, yes. Going into the show, I definitely did not think that I don't know. I guess I just went. I did. I was so bored in life, honestly. I think I just went on to have a story to tell. I think that's why a lot of people probably go on, you know, any reality show. It's just like, this will be hilarious to tell my kids.
So you didn't think about it like, this is a stepping stone for my next thing, or like, this is the thing that I will do to then do the other thing that actually interests me?
No. I thought that
I love that.
Going a design cert would just be a really fun story and experience. And it was.
Did you have your site at that point? Or did you start it like concurrently with the filming?
I started it in January 2010. And I think I left April 2010 for the 6 weeks.
So were you going through that process already?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that—
You just started your own site for your own pleasure.
Yep.
Because you were bored?
I was so bored. Like, I grew up journaling. I have just, like, I just found, like, 3 more journals when I was home last week. I wanted to do that, like, especially in the name of style and design. You know, the blog world, 2010, the blog world was beginning to pick up.
Yeah.
And I did know that if I could get on the beginning of that, it could potentially shift my career. That part I didn't know. But the show I thought was just like maybe more people would come to the blog.
Got it. Okay.
So
did you have a plan for the blog early on? Were you like, this is my editorial calendar and these are the types of stories I'm going to create? Or was it really just a like just go with the flow, update when you felt like updating, write however you wanted?
So I had a goal to write 5 days a week, and I did that. And I emailed a bunch of the bloggers and my friends and said, like, hey, I'm Emily, I'm new. And will you come look at my site? And so they did start sharing because there's so few of us that, like, that's what we did. We just, like, share each other's content. And I don't know how many people came, but the right people did. And I think it helped get me on the show. But it seemed like I had an audience relatively quickly. And it might have been hundreds, but still to write down your thoughts about whether purple is trending just from your apartment is and then have hundreds of people read it. It did feel very satisfying already. And so then once you get a little bit of that satisfaction and you're like, oh, what I'm writing, people are reading and people are affected by and influenced by the big buzzword of the century. Then you want to write even more.
So you did Design Star. You won Design Star, and then you got your own show. How did that go? Did you like it? Was that scary? Was it everything you wanted it to be?
It was so fun. Shooting that show was so fun. It was an insane amount of work. It was 6 days a week shooting, designing the next week and the week after that while we were shooting. It was just Orlando. Orlando,
yes.
Who we all know and love. He was my sidekick, and it was just—
Did you guys know each other before the show?
No. Orlando got cast on the show. It was—
That's your meet cute?
Yes.
I didn't know that. That's so lovely.
Yes, and it's so cute. I remember meeting him at the Coffee Bean on Hillhurst, and kind of interviewing him. And I just remember when he corrected me that his name was Orlando and not Orlando, I just remember being like, oh, God. And then after 10 minutes, I was like, I think I love this person. And after the first episode where we actually stayed the night in the homeowner's house because we were there until 2 in the morning, our call time was at 6. The cameras had left at, you know, 6 p.m. But we were there working so late. And we were just bonded from that. From that week forward, it was great. We spent 2 years, way more together, but 2 years shooting together.
So One thing that I think a lot of times when people think, oh, you have a show, they think that you just like show up and stuff happens. But you were incredibly hands-on.
Yes. We did all of the design, all of the styling, all of the hanging of the art. Like we put together all the furniture. We had a couple PAs, sure. But there, no, it was an insane amount of work. It's really why I'm hesitant to do it again while I have small kids. It was probably 60 or 70 hours a week.
And not to take anything away from what skills you were working with, I also feel like that's got to be crazy, though, because it's prop styling writ large, because it's design. And that's not necessarily completely what you had been doing. How did you feel like you knew what you were doing? Were you researching? Were you just getting your 10,000 hours on the job? Like, how did you figure stuff out?
I definitely – the learning curve was high, I'll say that. The show was a styling show. It was not a how to interior design your house. It was more, infusing personality and style into your home. So, but there was
That's
definitely –
still a design.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of
– You can slice it however you want. That's still a lot of design.
I mean, I had no idea what the function of a window treatment really was. On set, you would just duct tape it up. That's what you would do, you know? So then I didn't know the difference between Romans and drapery curtain. Like, I just – like, stuff like that, we did have to Google. And honestly, you just Google for the rest of your life how to do design, because that's all we do now, too. But the learning curve was high. We did have some – help. Like, every now and again, a producer would step in and be like, I think that you're, like, that color's looking a little bit crazy. And be like, oh, okay, thank you. But it wasn't scary, because it just didn't feel like that there was that much of a risk. So what if this doesn't work out? Like, I'm not going to die if I don't get picked up, or if people don't watch this episode. It was very much, it didn't feel stressful. It was just a lot of work.
So you did 2 seasons, so mm-hmm. 2 years. And then what happened next?
Okay. After the show, I guess we started with residential clients. Yeah, that's what we did. And I really kept up the blog. I knew this entire time the blog is the one thing I can count on, and the blog was gaining traffic. And blogs were gaining traffic.
Were you monetizing the blog?
I don't think I monetized until 2014, so I guess it was the first 4 years. I mean, maybe I made like $1,000 here and there,
like
using
affiliate links.
Yeah.
And whatnot.
No, I didn't. I did not affiliate until probably 2015. Yeah. So I didn't know how to. Nobody told me.
So not monetizing in that way. No affiliate Mm-mm. links.
I didn't have ads on the blog until we rebranded in 2014, because I was like, I mean, how much money could they possibly make? And that is a nauseating regret as well.
Do you have employees at this point, or is it 100% you?
Right after the show, it was just Orlando and I. So we stayed together as a team doing residential design and the blog. But I really did most of the blog. The blog was still a hobby. It was not. It was good for marketing, and it was a daily business card that I put out there, but it was not.
So it was
something.
Still 5 days a week?
I think so. Maybe four, but
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
I mean, I was like, we're going to get into this in a minute, but I mean, I have to ask you about your time management skills, because I do get a hint of them from reading your site, where you're like, it's 4 a.m. and everyone's asleep. So I'm here. You seem to pack more into the day than the average person, which I'm impressed by. So you started doing residential stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you'd never done this before.
No, and I did not know how to make money from running a design firm, that's for sure.
I was going to say, did you know how to charge? Was it inbound?
Yeah, I mean, we were getting a lot of calls from the show, and I just essentially did what I always do. I just reached out to a bunch of established interior designers, and I said, how do you charge, whether it's hourly or fee-based? So I just kind of started experimenting, and I definitely didn't, I didn't profit as much as you would have thought at all. Also, I felt a little bit like a hack, so charging $150 an hour, multiple people at the. I was just like, if I wasted any of that time, I was like, well, I can't charge them that, you know? Or if it took me longer to find something than I felt like I should have, I would feel so bad. So I was just undercharging like crazy, which in retrospect, I actually think that that is a good thing to do because I was not ready to charge $150. You know what I mean? I was not. I don't think I should have. I didn't have the experience to. So I think that there's a lot of designers that come out and like, yeah, that's what designers charge, right? And you're just like, well, they charge that because they have years of experience and that they can bring to not making the mistakes that I made for the clients. Anyway, so that was a learning curve. That was very fun. I think I didn't want to go back to prop styling because I wanted to have more control over my schedule.
Okay, got it. How long were you focusing on this design element?
I guess we did. We did interior design.
And again, it's just the two of you?
We did have some help. But we had maybe a handful of clients at a time, still running the blog. And then as Orlando wanted to start phasing out so he could do his own thing, then that's right when Target came in.
Okay. And so did you have like an accountant? Did you have a lawyer? Did you have contracts? Or were it was just very... just doing it yourself, sending your own invoices.
Yes. I will say, if you want to talk regrets already, I wish I could go back in time and have set up a protocol, like QuickBooks early on. It was kind of a disaster. I had been freelance forever, and you just send out an invoice, and, you know, I wasn't calculating my hours properly, like I said, so I was, like, wildly undercharging, and no, I didn't have an accountant, and it was very stressful.
Got it. Okay. So then circa 2014-ish, Target calls. And what was that conversation like?
It was pretty surreal. You know, I had had an agent for a while, and I had had some larger partnerships, but this was like the partnership. You know, it's Target. So it was a series of interviews, Skype, FaceTime with the PR team and then with the in-house marketing and... When I got it, it was probably up to that point the most exciting point in my career, more than potentially even Design Star.
Interesting. So for those of our listeners who might not know, you are their home style expert for Target. And what did they pitch you? Like, what did that look like? What did that mean? Like, you would do X amount of things a year, you would work with them on what? I mean, like, what was the scope of what the plan was?
The original plan was mostly just PR. So I would talk to the press for them. So if there was an interview in Real Simple, for instance, they would call me and say, Real Simple wants some tips on how to style your mantle for fall. And I would give them tips and we would talk about some Target product that would be really beautiful on your mantle. So it was kind of like weaving in Target when speaking to press. And then it was a lot of blogging about Target product. It was going to events, but it was styling my house out for magazine shoots, interweaving, you know, Target in with what I already had. And it was really, I don't want to say it was easy, but they're, you know, honestly, the product
natural.
Was so good. It was very natural. I was a very good fit for both of us. And then since then, it's really shifted into a lot more marketing and production. And less, I still talk to, you know, I'm still, I think they're quote unquote spokesperson, but it's more about creating content for them and really doing these larger projects that supports their marketing.
So how did you get into doing that? Was it your idea to expand things or was it their idea or did you guys come to it together?
It was kind of both. I mean, originally I wanted to do a makeover for my nanny's house and I wanted to get, you know, product for it so that she nor I had to, you know, spend a lot of money. So I pitched it to Target and they said sure that they would send product and we did it. And what we realized is that video was people loved it so much more than the, you know, the million-dollar campaigns that we had done together. And they were just more engaged, right? They loved that it was – my husband shot it. It was very run and gun. It was with a few assistants. It took a few days. It was successful because it just felt more, like, authentic and intimate. Yeah. And so once they realized that, they're like, well, why don't we keep doing things like that together? And that's where it has evolved. And they are great. They give a lot of creative freedom. They just say, hey, you know, let's talk about holiday. What do you want to do for holiday? What do you think that your readers would like? And how can we support it?
That's amazing.
It is. It is awesome.
So in 2015, your first book came out. Mm-hmm. There's another one in the works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so New York Times bestseller. That is crazy. How long did it take for you to put the book together?
2 years.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Because you had to shoot and create everything yourself, yeah?
It was all original photography. That is going to change for book two. I will say that. We shot a ton. It was a beast to write. I did have help too, but it took 2 years also because I was busy like being a new mom and running the blog and all the other partnerships. So halfway through, I definitely said to myself, I don't know if I should have done this. This is hard. I don't know if I, like, I was just like, should I back out of this right now? Like, I do not have time for this. And it was so stressful because they're like constantly deadlines, you know, you can't just say like, oh yeah, I'll get it to you, whatever. Like they have their deadlines they have to meet. And anyway, when it came out, it was the same week that I had my second baby. And so I didn't even promote it. Like I didn't go on a tour. I didn't do anything. I had done a lot of run and gun like PR before that to get it promoted by all of, you know, my friends that are in digital media and whatever. But it was crazy timing, and it came out and it did well. And then I was like, oh yeah, that was so fun to write. you know, it's like amnesia. You forget what it was, how hard it was to write. But
wait, so you had you were a new mom when you started the project, and then you had a baby at the very end of it.
Yes. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, I had two kids in the span of one book.
I mean, as someone with a 9-month-old, I really applaud your commitment to that project because that's a lot. That's a lot.
I had an amazing editor who ended up being my writer with me because she left Clarkson Potter, and I was like, no, I can't have you not on this project. So basically I hired her, and every Saturday I would be on walks with Charlie strapped to me on the phone, and I would just dictate the entire book to her. She would be like, okay, tell me your rules about styling out living room. Let's start with the pillows. And I would just talk through it, and she was just typing away the entire time. She would put it into cohesive sentences. But so it was this really interesting but awesome process. I don't know how else I would have gotten it done. I was already writing all week long for the blog, so I couldn't sit down and write on the weekends, but I can talk. I mean, I can talk. So that's how it got done.
This whole time you also – so you have the blog and writing for that. You have private clients that you're working with. You have the Target project ongoing. You wrote this book. At what point do you decide to like look at the full scope of what you're doing and maybe start to reevaluate like, okay, I can't do all of this all the time?
Last year, I got my financial reports back and I realized that the residential clients were 10% of the income. And they were causing me probably 40% of the stress. And I was definitely stressed out. Like I was definitely, I didn't want to talk about it all the time, but like in private, I was like, I'm 30% over capacity. And I cried way too much. And I didn't know what to give up because I'm not going to give up the blog. I love the blog. I'm not going to give up my kids. I love my kids, you know, and I love my partnerships. And so ultimately it came down to the residential clients, which was – it was a hard thing to give up because then I was like, well, what am I? Like as my father-in-law asked me afterwards, he goes, well, if you don't have any design clients, then wait, what do you do? And I was like, yeah, I know it's complicated like that I'm an interior designer with no clients, but it did make the most sense. And so instead we shifted to doing our own projects and buying – we bought a new house to then create content with, and then I've been working on this project with my brother. So the idea was not to stop designing. It was to do it on my terms and faster and with more transparency and honesty than I could do with the residential clients.
Well, I think that's something really interesting, too, because, you know, you don't have to get approval
mm-hmm.
on a faucet. You mm-hmm. can make that decision and you can say, I want to skimp on this paint, but I want to splurge on this material. And you don't have to justify that to anyone, yeah. right?
You're exactly right. I mean, here's the truth. I was also slowing down the process and that was stressing everybody out. So I was too busy to make approvals and I wanted to approve anything that was extremely permanent. Like I didn't have to approve pillows and lamps, but if it was, you know, a whole kitchen cabinetry plan, I should approve that before it goes into production. But they could not lock me down. The two designers that worked with me, Ginny and Mel, who are awesome, they couldn't lock me down. And so the clients are frustrated. Ginny and Mel were frustrated. That's where the stress was coming. The stress wasn't coming because having clients is stressful. The stress was coming because I was disappointing them all day long. And that is real stress in life, I think, is when you are like ruining your relationships because of something that, you know, you can or cannot control. So it was honestly the best move. Ginny and Mel were ready to go out on their own. And we had just wrapped up a lot of client work. And it was very much like a clean, great, like, this is what's best for everybody here. For me to focus on my own project. So the only person I can disappoint is myself and my audience. But when I disappoint the audience by doing something wrong, everybody learns something from it. So that doesn't really stress me out. Like doing something and messing it up is actually like it's a learning process for all of us.
So I noticed that maybe was it a year ago you changed your policy on comments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit and like what was the impetus for that? It sparked something. It made me think about comments, our behavior online in general in a different way.
I had up until 2017, last year, I had thought that the blog comments on my blog should be democratic. They should be able to say whatever they want. And typically when people said something negative, there were 15 people that then, you know, defended me. Obviously, there were times it was extremely hurtful, but it also, you know, created a conversation, it continued a dialogue and
community. Weird way.
Yeah. It was hard to let go of that. I was like, no, anybody should be able to comment here. Anybody. And then I found myself not going to the comment section at all. I was afraid of going to my own blog. I was having a decent amount of anxiety. And then I don't know what the final impetus was. I did not say there's no negative comments. I said, if you cannot say it to an 8-year-old, then you cannot say it on the blog and you'll be deleted. And that seems like a very reasonable thing to say.
Correct.
If you have negative criticism, you can say
that's
generally
valid.
Any of it to mm-hmm. an 8-year-old, you
yes.
know? But there's ways to say it where I could tell they wanted to ruin my day, and they did. So that had to stop. And it felt so good. Oh, my God. It felt so good. I was liberated. I wanted to go to the blog again. It was kind of complicated because that meant that the comments would have to be read before I read them, and not all of them were caught. But they stopped coming because I think that they were just like, well, we're just going to get deleted.
Yeah.
Like, why waste our time?
So one of the things that we talk about on this pod a lot is practical stuff. So I hear from women and men, listeners, who really know that they want to do something else, but they're a little bit afraid. Maybe it's just, you know, it's not jumping off a cliff. Maybe it's just jumping off a curb, but they're still nervous about making that change. What advice would you give someone who is interested in switching lanes in their career, whether it's like just one lane over or like crossing the freeway?
I wrote an article last year that was all about, it basically was like just start. And that seems like a very like broad esoteric term. But I think, you know, we all know that people get paralyzed and they're perfectionists and they don't want to put themselves out there yet. I'm not ready. And I wasn't ready. Most people that are creatively successful, we're not ready. Like you're not calculated. I didn't have a website before I had, you know, my first styling gig at all. So I would say, especially in the creative career department, to have a placeholder website and then do whatever you want to do on a very small scale and put it out there. I think everybody is waiting to have the final perfect product, whatever that is, before they show people. But like I said, you'll never, it's like,
that ain't gonna happen.
Yeah, you'll never get there. And also, it's not bad to have seven of a product. Like, then you'll get feedback and you will make that product better. So put it out to your closest friends and family. It's not like you have to, you know, take it to a gift show the first time, but your friends and family might say, like, oh, this is awesome. I wish it did more like this. Or, like, or say it's, you know, something you're writing, like, oh, this is great. Whatever, you're going to get feedback. That feedback will help you. It can be a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. Just showing somebody and saying, I'm thinking about doing this, and getting their response is so valuable to the trajectory of your product and your career. And it can really, like, you need that positive feedback to take it to a 6, 7, and 8.
Okay, I love that. So in this, like, very Instagram-y filtered world that we live in, I think it's also important to acknowledge some of the tough stuff that we have all been through in our careers. So what is the biggest mistake that you've made in your career, and what did you learn from it?
I've made so many, many mistakes, but there's a lot of mistakes that affect you temporarily or financially, or but the mistakes that have really caused me duress is hiring the wrong people or working with the wrong people. I'm a relationship person. I care about my relationships more than I do, you know, about how well the business is doing or about money or whatever. So when I have hired somebody that I have to, that we don't get along for whatever reason, or maybe we get along but they're not good enough for their job or whatever, I think that is what has – and it's happened multiple times over 10 years, but that is what has caused me the most stress. So I now learn from it, and I vet people better. I don't hire emotionally anymore. As much as possible, I have more boundaries. I'm trying to be a better boss, but there's just been a few instances where I could look back and be like, that year, like, that was so stressful because I didn't work with the right person, and it just made that job really, really, really hard.
I appreciate that candor, because I think that it is something that people gloss over when they talk about building teams and about all this stuff. Like, no one teaches you how to hire. I think we were lucky in the sense that we started with interns for a long time. I mean, Catherine and I ran the company for several years before we hired anyone at all. At least we were able to start the interview process and start to get that under our belt, where we were making edit tests and certain things to try and engage, like, what the skill sets were. But I still find it really tricky. It's like someone on paper and then might look great, and then you meet them in person and they seem great, but that doesn't mean that in the day-to-day that they're going to be great at their job or great for you. And these are long-term relationships, and firing people is very hard and complicated and also awful. And it's rough when you're realizing, like, that what you want from the person and what they can give you are not the same thing. It's so tricky.
Have you
figured out anything to help? Have you figured out any hacks for being better at hiring?
I will say this. When the red flags start, like, cut it off early. I think that's where I have made the biggest mistake. It's not necessarily hiring – you're always going to hire some people that aren't the right fit. Like, that's just going to happen. But I hate when people don't like me, and when I don't want to upset people. And so I have in the past let people slide for much longer, and it just gets more painful for everybody involved. So it's, if you get a red flag, that feeling in your stomach that you're like, I don't think this is the right fit, then reevaluate as soon as possible.
I also think there's something to the fact that, like, no one knows what you want. Mm-hmm. Unless you tell them. So sometimes there were things where I would see someone doing something that would, like, drive me up a wall, but I wouldn't say anything. And then it just would drive me up a wall even more and more and more. But it's like, they don't know that they're driving me crazy in this way because I'm not telling them. You have to, like, communicate what you need from someone so that at least it's on the table, and not expect someone to also read your mind.
Oh, I mean, that is the biggest joke in my company is I'm very at this point assertive and clear as much as possible, but it is you just, as a business owner, as you know, you just have all these thoughts going through your head. And you're just like, oh, my God, getting them out of my mouth is going to take so long. But I have to, because otherwise there's no guidance. Mm-hmm. And so I really wish that there was had been some sort of, like, how to be a good manager, like, seminar that I'd gone to 5 years ago. Because I have an amazing team of people. At this point, I mean, they're so good. And I can leave for weeks on a different project and come back. And they have... they've worked so hard. They care. You know, I'm so happy with who I have. I wish that in the past I'd been a better manager, because I think it would have saved me a lot of stress.
Got it. Okay. I know you're not a huge 5-year, 2-year, 10-year goal person. But what are you working on now? Like, I know the Oregon project is wrapping, mm-hmm. right?
The Portland project that was a flip with my brother. I shouldn't even call it a flip.
Can we explain the Portland project to everyone?
Okay. So I'm from Portland, Oregon. My brother and his wife invested in a property that he asked me to flip with him. And I said, sure, because we needed the content and it would be a really good opportunity to be creative without having a client. And, you know, it was kind of a show house in a lot of ways. And that took about a year. That was very challenging.
It was going to be as challenging as it was?
No, I did not know. I thought we were going to do like a 1,500 square foot like bungalow. That was the original like proposal, and it ended up being a 5,000 square foot, like not a new build, but 2,500 of that was new build. And the scope of work was just far more than I thought it was going to be. But now it was fun. I mean, my brother and I get along so well. So it was actually, it was very, very fun. So we are still shooting that. It's on the market as of today. In September is when we really are going to start showing it to everybody. So then I also have this mountain house that is more of an audience feedback, kind of like
co-design, right?
Yes. So we're calling it I Design, You Decide, where I will give the audience two different design plans for each room, and they get to choose which one gets implemented.
But what if the audience picks something you hate? Well, I mean, it wouldn't, because they're both your ideas, but...
But therein lies the huge challenge. So we have to, and I say we, like my husband and I both have to be equally happy with each design plan, and that has proved to be incredibly impossible. Basically, it's just been literally double the work. It's like we're designing two houses. So it's been so fun, and it honestly, I've learned so much throughout it, because I basically, instead of designing, you know, 3 bathrooms, I designed 6 for that house. And that is really good for me to learn and good for me to teach and say, like, you know, here are the things I would have done differently, even in that design plan or whatever. So it's really exciting, though. It's very fun. And, you know, there's a big contest element where the more times you vote and then share on social media there, then you get entered into a contest to spend a week up there with as many as your friends as can fit in this house, which I think is like 10, and expenses paid and everything. Anyway, so the contest it's a pretty fun one, and people are definitely like highly engaged. We are relaunching the site next month to be more of a resource, more navigatable, not like turning into a huge website, but as if you follow the blog, it's like it's a daily blog roll. So we'll do all these like huge, robust posts. It's like, you know, the best wallpaper in the world right now. And then in 3 days, it's gone. It's like you have to then Google for it. It's not really, or search for it on the blog. So we're just revamping it to make it so it's way more, you can actually find all these resources a lot easier.
What about another book?
Yes, I do have another book coming out. We haven't even started shooting it, but it's going to be a lot faster than the previous one. We're starting it in January.
What about another TV show?
The TV thing I'm probably going to readdress after the kids are in school.
My last question is always my favorite question. If you could go back in time and talk to, I don't know, let's say 90s Emily, and give her some advice, what advice would you like to share with your younger self?
I used to say that I didn't regret not going to design school. I was like, no, I learned on the job and so can you, kind of thing. But I do think that I wish that I had just gotten more skills. There are times where I feel pretty helpless in the office and I feel like I have to ask everybody, literally everybody else in the office, to do something for me because I can't do it myself, and that can be kind of frustrated. Luckily, I have such wonderful people that they do it quickly, but I do wish I had more skills in business and in design and in general. Like, I feel like I know how to I can write how I think and I can style shots, but there's these missing components to the business that I wish I would have learned 10 years ago because I don't really have time to now. So just get your skills together.
Got it. Okay. Toolkit.
Toolkit.
Get your toolkit in order.
Even if you're a creative, you should still know how to, like, get yourself on QuickBooks immediately. Like, the second you have anything to sell, get yourself on QuickBooks. Like, I didn't for so long, and it was a disaster.
All right. Well, that is great advice. Thank you, Emily. This was amazing. That was home style expert and design guru, Emily Henderson. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We even have a Facebook page, just saying. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com if you're into email, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.